originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I'd like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 201, and also to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. So a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you're able to help, please visit the website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening, he won 2 National Steeplechase Association Jockey Championships. He won the Grade 1 New York Turf Riders Cup twice, first with Chief of Clan in 87 and again in 93 with Warm Spell. They went on to win an Eclipse Award in 1994 after capturing the Breeders' Cup Grand National Hurdle. He's now a multiple graded stakes winning trainer with 136 wins as a jockey and 419 as a trainer. It's a pleasure to introduce James Chuck Lawrence. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Great having you here, Chuck. I mentioned earlier, we've only had one steeplechase jockey on the show before, so I can't wait to hear your story, hear your experiences. And you grew up in the world of horse racing. Your father was a trainer. Your grandfather was a trainer. So I guess that's pretty much what you always wanted to do.
From a very young age, I wanted to be a flat jockey. And I used to wear my dad's racing silks to school when I was in third grade. And he bred a little Welsh pony to a racing quarter horse, and we got little Fritz, my race pony, and the rest is history. So
So you would wear your silks to school. What a funny story. What did the other kids think of you?
Well, I think they thought it was a little bit odd, you know, because I was always after school riding horses or on the weekends riding pony races or galloping, mainly galloping horses. And, I started galloping when I was at the racetrack when I was 13 and always had plenty of money. A lot of people liked me because of that, as a kid having $100 in your pocket. But it was different to everybody else because instead of playing football or whatever, I was riding ponies.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up right outside of Middleburg, Virginia. And my father trained at a training track called Belvoir. And we would ship over to the Middleburg training track or Charlestown to do serious works or gate works. But it was a great life growing up there in Northern Virginia with the Middleburg horsemen.
Yeah, that's definitely horse country. Going to Charlestown. Now, I rode at Charlestown, so I guess you would. Did you do a lot of gate work there for your dad? You learned at a young age, I guess, how to get a horse out of the gate.
We did, and when I was 16, I rode just a handful of races, but I rode at Charlestown and a little bit at Bowie. But it was a great experience that led me into. Luckily, I was too big very quickly, and it led me to being a steeplechase jockey. So
how did you go from having aspirations to becoming a flat jockey? Then you turned to steeplechase. Obviously, you said that was because of the weight. But how did you find that avenue?
Well, of course, we were right in the area four with all the point-to-points. Growing up in the pony races, that's where the pony races were in our area. And so from fox hunting as a kid, jumping fences and different things like that, when the weight to I was struggling to do 20-22, and an owner, my father, said, "Son, you need to go work for Burley Cox, a Hall of Fame trainer." And luckily, I think this first six horses he put me on, I won, and one of them being the Carolina Cup, which was a huge stake back then. And it just got very lucky. Good horses, good horsemen, and good horses that I was around.
So you found success early on, but you mentioned the pony races and the point-to-point. And let's talk about that a little bit. The articles I read on you, Chuck, focused primarily on that horse you mentioned, Little Fritz. And sounds like you guys had a lot of fun together. And tell us about those experiences as a young boy traveling around and competing together.
Well, you know, it was really a really great experience because it gave you the same feeling that I have today in anticipation and anxiety for a race, the same as when I was racing that little pony. I'd ride in the back of the trailer with him on the way to the races, and he's pawing, and I'm worried that he's going to use all his energy pawing on the trailer and, walking the race course, riding the pony races and different things. It really was a huge stepping stone to where I am today. And, the work ethic of training the little pony every day and everything like that. Just, I think I rode my first pony race when I was 10. And he was named after my grandfather. And he went through, I don't know, 8 or 10 kids after me. He had a great life as a race pony. He lived well in, up to, I think, 38 years old. And he won about that many races at the point-to-points.
That's amazing. 38 years old. You don't often hear that. He obviously had a very good life and enjoyed it. And as a young, you're 10 years old, you won your first race, you mentioned. Now, were you competing against other kids your age at that time?
I was. Ricky Hendricks, who was champion jockey, he was a few years older than I, but was competing against him, and Bernie Houghton, Jeff Teeter, all the kids that went on to be steeplechase jockeys and top steeplechase jockeys, most of them did the pony racing. And it's just a great avenue for the kids to have fun.
Now, what did your parents think of this when you're competing at such a young age? Obviously, there are dangers involved, as we all know. So what did they think of you at this age and then when you went on to pursue a professional career?
Well, my father... my parents both backed me 100%. My father would take me to the barn before school, take me to the barn after school. My mother, at the races, would close her eyes when I jumped. And she was a great supporter, but she didn't like watching me ride over fences, I would have to say.
Yeah, I can't imagine. My own mother, she did the same thing. Riding jump races, I mean, I used to think steeplechase jockeys were crazy because that's even more dangerous than riding on the flat. And so tell us, throughout your career, what kind of injuries did you go through?
Well, I was very lucky in the fact that riding good horses, and good horses make you look good. And I had just a few injuries. I think I broke my collarbone 6 times, my heel, and got knocked out a couple times, and a few ribs here and there. But overall, I was very lucky not to have too many injuries. So I'm very lucky today. The only thing that bothers me is my knees. And my wife would say that my head injuries, because I've selective hearing, she says.
You can use that to your advantage sometimes, I'm sure, right?
Yes.
Chuck Lawrence joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Chuck, you mentioned you learned from Burley Cox, a Hall of Fame trainer, and he had such great horses, such great stock for you to ride. So when you went to work for him, I'm sure you learned a lot. And tell us specifically what he taught you.
Well, number one, he was just an unbelievable horseman. He could walk through the barn and see something was wrong with the horse without even going in the stall, just by, because he knew his horses. He knew he was standing different or acting different. He just taught you to use your eye, everything. And he was just, I just can't tell you what a remarkable horseman he was, how much he loved the horses, loved racing. But he had just a soft touch with the horse, and just an unbelievable horseman. He didn't need a scale. He could do it all by eye. I can remember him telling me, that horse lost, 30 pounds in the work or something like that. And I take back and I stand back and look at the horse, and he said, he's right. Different things like that. And he was just a remarkable horseman. I was just so lucky to have spent time with him, those early stages.
Did he pinpoint anything you needed to work on as far as riding goes? Would he help you along the road with that as well?
Well, I lived on the farm, so I would get done, clean tack, and I'd talk to him in the tack room. Then I'd go over and sit in his study, little office, and get him talking about the old days and different things. And he was really big on hands, and really having soft hands, and how to hold the reins, and how to talk to the horse through your legs and your hands, and he really helped me with that, and I think that was the biggest thing with my riding. That he would critique your riding, and he loved different bits and rigs and things for horses, and you had to be a very adept rider to use these different draw reins and bits and different things. And he just really made me an all-around horseman riding.
Chuck, now as a trainer, do you find yourself using his methods towards horses and choosing a rider now?
Yeah. Funny enough, I stopped off. I'm in Camden right now with a horse, South Carolina. I stopped off here last night. We're going to be here for 3 days and then ship on down to Gulfstream for the Fort Lauderdale. And I just stopped in here to break the trip up from Fairhill to Gulfstream. And I was telling somebody this morning, I say he looks like a Cox horse because he eats about 18 quarts a day. This horse is well muscled. He's got plenty of flesh to him, but he's very fit. And it's funny you say that because I was referring to my horse this morning. He looks like a Cox horse.
Is that Glorious Empire?
Yes, Glorious Empire. Yes, ma'am.
We'll talk about him in great detail, Chuck, during the second half of the show. But during this first part, I really want to focus on your riding career. And so I rode races as a flat jockey, and I had an agent. And the day-to-day work, you go out and you work horses in the morning, then you ride 8 to 10 races a day in the afternoon, and you ship around riding races day and night. But as a steeplechase jockey, it's different because you don't have 8 races a day to ride. So tell us what your day-to-day life was like and what was your riding schedule like?
The steeplechase jockeys, unlike the flat jockeys, kind of had to do a little bit of everything. It wouldn't be out of the question to have to muck a stall, to come back in the afternoons, to do everything. To do horses up, weed eat around the farm, mow the paddocks, and harrow the track. So it's a little bit different than being a flat jockey. That today you see these flat jockeys go from a hob walker to a jockey in a matter of months, which is amazing. where the steeplechase jockey does have a little bit more background and horsemanship, because they have to do everything. And at least they did back when I was riding. I don't know about today, but when we had to do everything in the barn, from feeling legs and taking temperatures, so in the morning, help get the horses out and trained, and then after they were done, you walked hots, and the horses that didn't train for the day, things like that, grazed horses, iced horses, hosed them. So it was a good background.
I'm of a firm belief, Chuck, that every jockey should come up that way. I think that's a great way to learn overall horsemanship, as you mentioned. Now, during your career, did you ride primarily for Burley Cox? I know, talking to riders from back in the day, they had contracts with certain trainers. Did you have a contract with him?
I did not have a contract with him. Gave him first call, and then I rode outside horses. And that's just kind of how I did it. There were riders that got contracts and different things like that, but primarily just rode for him, and then picked up outside horses. And it worked well for me. So unlike the flat jockeys that are riding, 5 days a week, 5-6 days a week, the steeplechase jockeys ride 1, maybe 2 days a week, and during the week, when we get done, we'd play golf, and then I would run in the afternoons to help my wind and fitness and things like that. But on the weekends, we were traveling, because you might be based in Pennsylvania, but you're riding in Maryland or Georgia or South Carolina. There's a lot of traveling.
Was it hard for you, traveling and riding a couple of days a week, was it hard for you to maintain your weight?
I was very lucky, because I had been a flat jockey, and I was naturally around 128, 130 at the time. The steeplechase weights were easy for me. The bottom weight was 632, the high weight being like 65. So 165, 132. So I was able to do the weights pretty easily. So I gave it my all and tried to give it my all in every race. And I wanted to be fitter than the guy next to me, because I wanted to win. So I did extra workouts.
I can only imagine how fit you had to be to go these long distances, going over jumps. I can only imagine. Obviously, any jockey has to be ridiculously fit, but especially a steeplechase jockey. And did you notice, given that you rode flat races as well, did you notice a difference? Did you focus on your upper body more than your legs, or vice versa? Did you notice a difference between the two?
Well, you're in a different position. I think the biggest thing is you had to have core strength and arm strength to hold an individual, because you're trying to conserve your horse, go that tick slower. And with the steeplechase, it's so important with when you can change, because a lot of the courses are turning left and are kind of in an oval, in a field, to be able to get the horse to change to the outside lead and conserve himself and change lead as much as you could throughout the race, to conserve energy and have that blast at the end of the last part, having horse. So having that strength to be able to hold that horse just that tick slower instead of letting him run off in the race, I think the fitness for that.
Chuck, let's talk about one particular horse. You mentioned that you did ride primarily for Burley Cox, and one of the horses you rode for him, Chief of Clan, as I mentioned, that was your first victory in the Grade 1 New York Turf Riders Cup. So tell us about that horse and what that victory meant to you.
Well, one of my best friends to this day is Ricky Hendrickson. He was riding for Mr. Cox, and he rode the horse first time out and won one, but he cut somebody off in the race and got taken down. And the owner, Miss Joseph Walker, got so upset, she said, "I never want Ricky on one of my horses." And I was the bug rider, apprentice rider in the barn, and Mr. Cox put me on him. And he jumped like he was a very efficient hurdle horse. He was one of the quickest jumpers I've ever been on in my life, but he barely skimmed the fence. You never even knew he jumped the fence hardly. So he was really, really fast that way-wise. But anyway, I got the ride on him and went on to be novice horse of the year, won the turf riders, and it was all due to Ricky getting taken down in a race. It was very lucky for me.
Bad for Ricky, good for you.
Yes.
So did you win the Grade 1 New York Turf Riders as an apprentice?
I believe I was, yes.
Wow.
Yes. So I've had a storied career because I just got on a lot of good horses, and as you know, you're only as good as the mount underneath of you. And good horses make you look good.
Oh, I'm going to have to look in the record books and see if that had ever been done before, an apprentice winning that race. That is quite the accomplishment. Now, talk a little bit about having an apprentice as a steeplechase jockey. What were the weight differences, and how long did you have the bug for?
You know, I'll be honest with you, it was so long ago, I can't remember. I believe I still had the apprentice allowance at that time. I can't promise you. I know it was my second year riding, but I'm not sure. But it's very similar to the flat, the apprentice allowance, but I think it's done on the number of wins you have, which I cannot remember how many that is, whether it's 10 or 20. So,
well, let's
before you lose it. So I can't remember. So, but it you know, it's definitely. I think I use it today with training. If there's a really good apprentice and you have a horse where you can get 5-10 pounds, especially when you start talking 10 pounds, I think it's a huge weight advantage. I know I've got, when I was riding the steeplechase, when those handicaps giving away 10-12 pounds, and you get beat a half a length, it's certainly the weight comes into play. And if you have a horse that just needs a good trip, I think the apprentices are a huge advantage with the weight advantage like that.
I'm glad you brought that up, Chuck. I've always wondered, I've heard different theories on this. Are you of the belief that you should use that weight advantage by using a bug when you're sprinting or going longer distances?
I think it's more it comes in more play going a distance of ground. I really do. I don't know. I think it's less of an advantage sprinting. Personally, I could be totally wrong. I'm sure there's people out there that have done the research on it, but I know that riding those handicaps at Saratoga and different things, that I was beaten by horses that a length or half a length, different things like that. I was given 10, 12, 14 pounds that on an even playing field would have beaten them easily by a few lengths. So I know the weight over distance of ground affects them. So.
Chuck Lawrence joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Chuck, I guess your best horse would have been Warm Spell, who won the Eclipse Award in 1994, won the Breeders' Cup Grand National Hurdle, won the Grade 1 New York Turf Riders' Cup, just to name a few. I believe, and I don't have it pulled up here at the moment, but I believe that horse won like a ridiculous number of races for a jump horse. And so tell us how you got the mount and tell us what the horse was like.
Dr. Johnny Griggs from Lexington, Kentucky, trained him, and his son rode him, Kurt Griggs. And the horse was very, very talented. And all you had to do is move your hands on him, and he would just blow by the field. So he did that in one race, and the horse flipped, had several tea kettle, excuse my French, and hurt Kurt real bad. And I got to ride and won the rest of the year, and I won the Temple Guathme, Turf Riders, Atlanta Cup. He was just an unbelievable horse. He beat Lonesome Glory, Mystique, all the good horses. His biggest fault was he set over 17 hands and had a huge stride, and he wasn't the best jumper because of that. He was so big. He had to meet the fence just right, and when he got in trouble, trapping, he had a hard time getting himself out of that, and that was his demise in the end. He fell with me in the Colonial Cup in 95, I think, and I'm sorry, 94, the fall of 94, and broke his shoulder.
Mm. How do you help a horse like that over a jump?
You just try to become one with the horse, be part of the horse. I always try to tell the youngsters, try to become one with the horse, be balanced with them, try to be going faster inside the wings than you were coming to it. So I'd always kind of sit back, take a deep breath and see your spot, and then kind of send them for the spot. It just seemed to work really well for me, trying to increase my momentum to the spot where I wanted to take off. And when you're going 30 miles an hour, it comes down to just a feel.
What was your most thrilling victory with Warm Spell?
Probably the Breeders' Cup Grand National. That was a huge win. I beat the best horses in the country, Mystico and Lonesome Glory, 9-10s. It was, I think back then the purse was $250,000. And it was a huge, huge win. I rode just a really smart race that day. Lonesome Glory had beat me before that race, I think in the Guathme. And he had stalked me the whole race and just got up to beat me, I think, ahead or something. And I said, I'll never let that happen again. I stalked him, and I beat him that way.
Well, Chuck, we have to take a quick commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanently Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use the monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Pena of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcotte. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too. And I thank you.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
And the trailers are Sandler's Joy and revved up, and they're coming to the top of the stretch. Glorious Empire, still there in the Sword Dancer, set down for another furlong, trying to keep this lead. Channel Maker is two lengths behind in second. The others need to get going now. Spring Quality is third, and Glorious Empire still got run. Glorious Empire's gonna do it all the way under Julian Leparo taking the Sword Dancer. And then it was Channel Maker second, followed by Spring Quality and High Happy.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by James Chuck Lawrence. Chuck, what do you feel when you hear that replay? Glorious Empire just won the Sword Dancer, the Grade 1 Sword Dancer this year. What do you feel?
I still get the cold chills and the hair goes up on the back of my neck. I don't get the hoarseness because I was yelling so hard. But my whole family was there. What an honor to win a Grade 1 at Saratoga.
Quite an amazing race, and we'll talk about Glorious Empire here in just a second in great detail. But really quickly, I want to wrap up your riding career here, and we were talking about Warm Spell prior to the break. And Warm Spell won the Eclipse Award in 1994. Were you there for the ceremony?
I was not. No, I believe that I don't know, for whatever reason, I was not there, no ma'am.
Nonetheless, that had to be a pretty amazing feeling when you got the news that he received the award.
Oh, huge honor to have ridden. I was very lucky in my career to have ridden sat on three horses that won an Eclipse Award. I won on Lonesome Glory early in his career before he won an Eclipse Award, and won a prep race on a horse called Hereafter. And they were all three unbelievable horses. So very, very lucky to have thrown a leg up over those three horses for sure.
Who is the nicest horse you ever sat on?
I rode a horse for Bruce Miller called Uptown Swell. And Virginia Craft Payson had bred him and raised him on the flat. I'd be wrong, made about $1 million on the flat. But he was a really nice stake horse on the flat. And I got to ride him over fences. And I won some really nice, he had a really nice turn of foot. He was definitely one of them with Warm Spell, and Chief of the Clan was probably the best jumper that I'd ever rode. He was just so fast over a fence. So I can't pick one.
too many to name, right?
Yes.
You rode go ahead.
I think that my biggest, one of my biggest feat was I won the International Gold Cup, which is a 4-mile timber race on a horse called Jamaica Bay, and all he had on was a hackmore, no bit in his mouth, and I thought that was a hell of a feat.
That's amazing! Oh my gosh, yeah. Never heard of that before. Wow.
Yeah, all I did was guide him, just running off the whole time. We set a course record, but it was quite a feat, I thought.
Did you ever ride out of the country?
I did. I've had the honor of riding a little bit in England, Australia. Won a race in Australia, and a lot of fun. It I still think the racing here is just unbelievable. You know, we're so lucky in this country with everything we have.
What are the differences you noticed with your experience riding overseas? What are the differences between racing here and over there?
Well, the speed over here, the speed of the flat races on the firm ground. The other countries, the turf is a lot softer, so they go a lot slower at the beginning and sit and wait to make the run home. Here, more often than not, you're running on very, very firm ground, and it's a much faster game here. And it's harder on the riders because the ground's hard. When you fall, you get hurt.
Anything you think we could adopt that maybe you preferred over there?
I think that we have started to adopt different things like that. They mark the fences much better, you know, the ground line, the takeoff line, and different things like that to give the horse and the rider, you know, something more to put their eye on and spot and help the horse with jumping the fence, doing safety with the fence. Even in foreign countries on flat racing, I think that this country's so geared to sprint racing. It's a shame we've gotten away from distance races, and distance races keeps horses, in my opinion, sounder. You're just going that tick slower. When you're going 22 and change, it's a lot more stress on the horse.
Chuck, you rode your...
I think in the foreign countries, that they tend to wait. It's much more emphasis on the end of the race than it finishing up. And maybe that's due to the softer going. So.
Chuck, you rode your last race on July 13th, 2003 at Colonial Downs, which I love Colonial yeah. Downs, by the way. I rode there 1 year. What made you retire?
I came back because I really missed it. I rode a few of the flat amateur races that they had, and it was fun just because I love race riding. And still today, when I walk by the jocks room, the smell of the jocks room, different things, it brings back memories and makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck. And I still miss it. It was a great time in my life. I loved going fast and trying to outride the rider beside me. I always thought that I could convince my horse to give me that extra little bit to beat the guy next to me. Oh, girl, as Blythe Miller beat us, all of the boys all the time.
So you said you kind of made a comeback then to ride some amateur races. But when you originally retired, what year was that?
I did retire in the spring of 95. I had an opportunity to train and full time, and that's what I did. But I'd been champion jockey twice, and then I'd ridden an Eclipse Award winner, and I just thought that I would use the momentum into the training.
Was that always a goal of yours, even when you were riding, to someday become a trainer?
It was. I guess to be an all-around horseman. I went to horseshoeing school while I was shoeing horses and leading trainer in the country. I mean, leading rider in the country in 93 is pretty neat. And I think it was 93. The first race at Saratoga, I won, and I was leading trainer, leading jockey for the Saratoga meet for one race.
Quite the combination.
Yeah, so that was pretty neat. So. But I've always had a passion for the horses, being able to, and luckily a God-given talent of being able to do things with horses that other people couldn't. And I just have always had a connection with a horse, particularly when I'm on them, being able to get them to do things that other people couldn't. And that's something that God gave me. So I was very lucky, you know, working with good horses and being able to get them to give me their best.
How was it for you during those early days of training? What was that transition like for you?
Well, it was a little frustrating, still frustrating today, because as a jockey, I could make things happen. And you know what I mean. You can make things happen. As a trainer, I have to think about the next race with the horse. If the horse is dead last by 30, I have to go back. I have to talk to the owner, and I can't just say walk away from the owner and say, well, I'm not going to ride that horse again. I have to go back and say, what am I going to do with this horse to fix him? I've got to go back here and change something in my training to get this horse to produce. And I think that's the hard part from riding. We're riding, you might be able to change something with your tactic or style or whatever, but if the horse is not performing and you're the trainer, you're starting to get the blame for him and you have to go back and figure it out. And it keeps you up at night. So.
Chuck, I'll be honest. I had people come up to me when I retired and, why don't you train horses? And what you just described is why I don't want to train horses, because that's tough. You have so much responsibility, and basically it's your job to fix everything. And I'm sure that is a lot of pressure. I can only imagine. But obviously,
it's unbelievable. And I mean, people don't understand if you study the horses going to the Derby, the Breeders' Cup. The horses that, get hurt, come up with a temperature, pull a shoe, have a hot foot. I mean, it is a very stressful job, and you have to take a lot of deep breaths and just do the best you can and be honest with people. That's the biggest thing you can do.
Well, everything's been going well for Glorious Empire since he fell in your lap, basically. That horse has a very interesting story, and I would like to talk about that now. He ran in Europe and had a big problem bleeding, and he was always thought of as a very nice horse with a lot of capability, but never really was able to do much because, obviously, they don't have Lasix overseas. So tell us how you got the horse, and basically what did you do to fix him?
Well, Matt claimed him, and they had success right away with him. He won a nice claiming race at Saratoga. They ran him back, I think, in the Bernard Baruch, and he bled, and they, I think, turned him out or stopped him or whatever, and he was sent to Fairhill to do the therapy center there, and then they turned him out, and Matt was like, I don't know. What do you think, Chuck? I might retire this horse and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, I'd like a shot with him at Fair Hill. And sure enough, he gave me a shot with him. And we just tried to do things where he came with a bad reputation of being a handful in the paddock on race day and different things like that. And we did things like put him on the van and ship him to the races when I had other horses in and paddock school him and different doing that type of things with him and tried to make it a fun experience for him and so he wouldn't get so nervous and hyped up on race day and also to figure out what worked well for him. So we did different experiments at the races on days when he wasn't in. We'd take him down and paddock school him and see what really with the Bleeders is keeping them quiet, keeping them calm, keeping them focused. And so everything's kind of geared towards that.
Well, and they actually thought about sprinting the horse originally, I guess, when he came over here. And you changed their minds on that.
Well, when I first got him and the first few times I breezed him, I told Matt, I said, this is one of the nicest horses or the best horse I've ever had in my life because he's just so talented in his breezes. And Matt had talked about running him in a sprint stake. And I was kind of on board for it because he had such a bad reputation as a bleeder. We thought, well, maybe we can hold him, you know, for 5/8 of a mile and win some races with him. But as I got to train him, I said, Matt, this horse would do anything I ask him to do. I mean, he'll work a mile, and you can set him at any speed you want. And so we changed course, and when he won the race going a mile and 1/8 at Delaware, Edgar Potter, the Hall of Fame jockey, came back on him. He said, man, he said, Chucky, this horse will go further than 1/8. He said, I'd love to ride this horse 1¼ miles. So that's how the race at Saratoga came about.
And he won the Sword Dancer wire to wire, paid $33 that day. Of course, previously won the Grade 2 Bowling Green Stakes, also at Saratoga. And was his running style, was it always with speed going long, or did you train him to go to the front?
His style before was always coming from behind. Matt is very good looking at the numbers, looking at different things, and he thought that we could go to the front if we could slow it down, and the way he turns off and the turn of foot that he has, that we could outrun him. And that's what he did. So that's how we prepped him and tried to train him into the race.
He went 1.5 miles that day he won the Sword Dancer. And quite the journey you've had with him. Of course, he ran in the Breeders' Cup Turf here at Churchill Downs in November. And how did he come back from that race?
Well, we put him on the front end, and unfortunately, unlike the Sword Dancer, he wasn't able to slow the pace down and have a break in the middle of that. They went pretty solid the whole way. And Julian said he just knew that he wasn't handling the going. It rained all week that week, and he wasn't handling the turf like he was at Saratoga. And he just gave him an easy race, luckily. Because he came back and cooled out well and everything, so we're hoping that that was just a soft turf with a fast pace there that day.
Yeah, I was there, Chuck. The amount of rain we had was ridiculous, and I would have to look at all of the charts, but I don't think any horse on the grass went wire to wire that day. It's obviously very hard for a horse to sustain that pace on such soft going. But what are your plans with him now?
Well, we're on our way to Gulfstream for Saturday's Fort Lauderdale. We just stopped off in Camden, South Carolina to break it up. It's about a halfway point from Fair Hill. So we'll be here training for 3 days. Thursday we'll ship to Gulfstream, and then hopefully Saturday win the Fort Lauderdale, and then think about the Pegasus Cup on the turf in late January, hopefully.
We'll be looking for you in the winner's circle on Saturday, Chuck. And talk about a horse like that. Obviously, he sounds a little bit difficult, like a horse you have to keep happy. And I read an article where the champion skier, Bodie Miller, has teamed up with you, and he has kind of a new way of thinking as far as training goes and keeping the horse happy. So how do you do that? And talk about that method a little bit.
Well, the trainers at Fair Hill are so lucky in the fact that we have three tracks to pick from. And also there's 6,000-7,000 acres of open land, woods, fields, trails, or work strips. And if you can't make a horse happy there, you're not going to do it. And this horse, he trains out back 3 days a week, at least 3 days a week, and just doing nice long works with him. I think it was last Thursday, worked three quarters and 13, and then galloped out the 7/8 and 126, and so it was a good work. So he's got a good prep, and we're just trying to keep him happy. And coming down here to Camden, it's beautiful here at the training center and quiet. It's got nice turf gallops. So we thought it would be best to come here for a few days, go up the trip up, and then go down the Gulf Stream and take the money and get out, hopefully.
I love it. See the sun, get the nice warm weather down there, and hopefully enjoy the victory, Chuck. That sounds like a great plan. And your mentality with these long, slow works and on a day-to-day basis, I believe I read that you like to turn horses out in the pasture quite a bit. I read something about, I don't remember who said it, but how these 1,200,000-pound animals are cooped up in a stall for 23 hours a day, and it's not really fair to them when they're animals. They're meant to be outside in a field. So what's your thinking on that, and do you try to get a horse outside and get him to relax?
Well, what we do. Like I said, we're so lucky at Fair Hill to have paddocks and fields to hack them in and different things like that. And it's trying to get them back to being just a horse. But most barns also have European walkers. It's the free walkers where the horses go on, and they're not tethered. Most of mine all go on there first before they go to the track, so they're warmed up and the open space. It's just amazing. But the turnout is a big thing. I think letting a horse get up and roll and eat grass is just is Mother Nature and the natural horsemanship.
Chuck Lawrence joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Chuck, you said Glorious Empire might be the best horse you've ever had, but you had some other nice horses as well. The Dean won the Grade 3 Lawrence Realization Handicap in 96. Avanico won the Grade 2 Temple Hurdle Handicap in 99. And tell us about some of the other great horses you've trained throughout your career.
Well, I had a really nice horse, Maya Fleet. He won the Dueling Ground Derby and a stake up at Saratoga. He's a really nice horse. I've just been very lucky. You kind of get lost in the shuffle if you don't win graded stakes. And, you know, with a 20 horse stable, we're very lucky this year to have had Glorious Empire come our way. But the over the years we've had a lot of state bred stakes and overnight stakes, but getting the graded stakes is where you get the publicity and get the interviews and get the people calling. So we're hoping that we can get more graded stakes now.
Chuck, we only have a couple minutes left. This hour has flown by, but let's talk about, I know your family is very important to you. So tell us about your wife and your kids.
I'm very lucky to have a wife that supports me, and she loves horses, and she takes a lot of the racehorses that don't make it or at the end of the career and makes them into show horses and finds them new careers, hopefully. I've got a lot of them that I'm feeding, but my daughter rides daily. She's a beautiful rider. She's Ashby. She's 7, and she's trying to sneak her pony in the house all the time. She brings him in, and my son is a hell of a horseman. He rides, but his biggest thing is he just has a very natural touch with the horses. He helped me at Saratoga, and he's just a really good little horseman. He's getting ready. He's nine. Ashby's seven, and Chase is nine. Yep. And that's we're nothing but horses. We've got two farms in Fair Hill, and between the dogs, the cats, and the horses, we're busy.
How did you meet your wife?
She was a show rider and fox hunted. And she was down in Moncton, Maryland, and I met her at a cocktail party. And she had dated a former friend of mine, and I convinced her to come up to Fair Hill. So got lucky. I got lucky.
The rest is history. All right, Chuck. Now, now your kids. Now maybe a future jockey and trainer on your hands there.
Well, unfortunately, my son's nine and almost as tall as me. So. Now, my daughter, she has the hands for it, and she just might be. We'll see. She's doing the shows right now and everything, and she's just a brilliant little rider.
Well, Chuck, unfortunately, we are all out of time. Best of luck to you and your family. Wishing you all the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. Now, be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thanks for listening.